This is the Packet Pushers podcast, a place where more than 30 years of networking hasn't gathered any dust, but there's a massive pile of unpaid invoices full of little line items of technical debt, and we're trying to work out if the creditors are coming to collect this quarter, this year, next year, the year after. One day it's going to come crashing down on our heads. Today's show is another in our Future of Networking series. The future of networking is intended to look long into the future. Instead of just talking about what we have today, instead of covering a technology deep dive, instead of chatting about experiences in the real world, this is, let's put our rose-colored glasses off and peer onto the horizon where the lovely sailing ships and the desert islands with ukuleles playing and beautiful people with alcoholic drinks are there to tell us what the future will hold. Ethan and I are here, but most importantly, we have Jeff Houston here. Jeff, why don't you tell people a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yes, hi, I'm Jeff Houston. I'm currently this grandiose title of the Chief Scientist at APNIC. I'd actually call myself a refugee from the commercial carrier world. I was fortunate enough to be sort of biding my way around on the campus world in Australia when this thing called the internet popped up in the United States. And because I was at the Australian National University and they had pretensions of leadership, they said, we will help us build one here in Australia. And so, right person, right time, I put my hand up and said, that sounds like a whole barrel of fun. Late 80s, it was a whole barrel of fun.
And it's still a barrel of fun, 30 years later.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, so, yeah, I spent a few years building that and I really enjoyed it. And so when the telco came along and said, we're going to buy you, I thought, oh, yeah, well, worth the challenge. And so I served a 10-year sentence in the National Telco. You know, I did my time. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot about process. I learned much more than anyone should ever know about process. And, you know, I learned a lot about the trailing 50%, and that was a fine thing to learn. But, you know, 10 years is enough for any mortal body. So then I went off into this funny little group that hands out internet addresses. APNIC, we serve the Asia-Pacific region, and if you need an IP address, we're the folk you come to. There are other organisations that do the same role in North America, in Europe and the Middle East, in Africa and in South America and Latin America.
Yeah,
and that's those are the chaps. Mm. Yeah, so I work in the Asia-Pacific version of that. So our core business is addressing, but we are a network information centre. And certainly, you know, my job is just to poke around in things that amuse me. Which is a great job. and one of the things that's been amusing me for many, many years, because it's full of fodder, is, of course, the whole IPv6 saga.
Yeah.
So that's why I got into V6, yes.
So, but you've been rattling around the standards bodies. Like I've seen you've been hanging around the RIPE conferences, the IETF conferences, the ICANN boards. You've been heavily involved in that over the years, and you've been one of those people who've been, I guess, building the internet in a form.
Well, you know, things aren't finished. And that's, I suppose, the one big observation. The stuff we don't know about is so much larger than the minuscule amount of stuff we actually know about. Why are there source addresses in the header of IP packets? It's a really good question. Excuse my Australian. It's a really, really good question because if you think about it, the middle of the network shouldn't really have to go back and talk to the source. Mm-hmm. The source address only makes sense at the other end.
So it's like a TCP header.
Well, exactly. So a whole bunch of things, kind of unfinished business. Mm-hmm. And as the internet matures, we kind of take these unfinished questions and go, well, that's the truth. That's the only way of doing it.
Yes.
And we're wrong. And I think V6 is one of the most amazing sagas of proving to ourselves something completely different. Today was never, ever, ever, ever meant to happen.
Right.
We were never, ever meant to run out of IP addresses in version 4 and keep on running version 4. The whole sort of idea and theology of version 6, and, you know, I'm sad enough to admit it, but, you know, I'm one of those folk with graying beards that really was around there when we talked about this in 1989 at an IETF meeting when Frank Selinsky got up and said, you know, we're going to run out. And apart from the poo-poo, the next thing was, well, we better design something a bit bigger before we run out because running out would be a disaster.
Right.
And over the next 3 years, there was a lot of discussion, not about what running out meant. That was a given. It was a discussion about how many more bits to pack in the address space. And after, I suppose, the usual committee nonsense, You know, why do ATM cells have 53 bytes in them? Because it was designed by a committee, and the French and the English and the Americans hate each other. And so they couldn't do 32, they couldn't do 64, they compromised on 48, and they added 5 bytes just to be annoying.
Well, I remember I was there then, and the ATM people wanted it to be 24 bytes for their voice stuff.
Right, well, the Americans won, did they? I'm like, 48s is so much better. But you know, my point is the committee work is just horrible outcomes that please no one. Mm. And when you look at V4, you actually see just this brilliant simplicity that was sitting in the head of Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn. Mm. It was kind of their idea, and it was two brains big. You could understand it. Mm-hmm. V6 is really quite a funny kind of protocol. Solving a 32-bit problem by going to 128 bits is overkill. Getting rid of the low-order 64 bits and making them useless is bizarre bits of damage. But more to the point, we were meant to be a full V6 network by the back before we handed out the last V4 address. It was never meant to happen because networks need addresses, right?
Yes.
Wrong. Completely and totally wrong.
Okay.
How many addresses are in play in the public internet right now? Oh, look, I'll give you 2 billion. I'm wrong. It's really only 1 billion. Out of those 4 billion addresses, 1 billion actually respond with anything.
Out of a 4 billion possible IP addresses in the address space, IPv4 address space, you take away, you know, the top /4 because that's reserved from 224 up sort of thing.
Oh, that's a minor amount. But what I'm saying is, when I hand you a block of addresses, 256, often you only use the first 3 or the first 10. You don't use them all.
So people and have subnets with 256 or 1,000, you know, /22 with 1,000 addresses in it and then only use 10 or something.
Exactly. So out on the big internet, we've got about 3 billion addresses in play. Only 1,000 actually respond with anything. John Heidemann of USC, ISI actually, does a ping test from time to time. And, you know, astonishingly small amounts of folk actually respond. But anyway, about 1 billion. Hmm. How many devices are connected to the internet? Ask any punter out there, Gartner, Cisco, Forrester, you know, you name it. 10 billion is not a bad estimate.
Hmm.
10 billion, but they sit inside 1 billion addresses. So let's go back to this theory that every device needs an address. Well, obviously that's wrong. Every device doesn't need an address. We thought that when we were growing the network, and today we're selling what? 1.3 billion smartphones, about the same number of funny little devices, you know, the thing on my wrist, the thing on your door, the alarms, the this, the that, you know, the world of internet things. We're even selling 250 million desktops and laptops, you know, the dinosaurs of the internet. Mm. We're selling more than 2 billion units a year, but we gave out last year less than 30 million addresses. But all of those devices got connected somehow. Obviously, the answer is they're sitting behind network address translators in private address space, obviously. So all the clients don't need addresses, do they?
Well, they don't I think your point is they don't have to have addresses. There are other ways for us to make sure that they connect.
Right. So what I do is I go to my closest pool of addresses, the NAT, and if I'm a mobile phone, it's probably operated by the carrier. If I'm here at home, it might be operated by me, and the carrier might be operating one too. And for the lifetime of my conversations, I borrow an address and then I return it back to the pool. Mm. So addresses are ephemeral conversation tokens. Let's just park that thought for clients. You go, but it's all different for servers. www.google.com needs to be somewhere, doesn't it?
Yeah.
There's this funny little bunch of people in California, in San Francisco, and they're not funny and they're not little. They're deadly serious and they're really quite interesting. Their name is Cloudflare, and they'll take my web stuff and they'll host it for me. Now, if anyone asks for my domain name, they won't get my address or anything like it. They'll get the closest IP address of the closest Cloudflare data center. So my content no longer has an address either. But this is getting weird. When I, sitting at home, go to some content that I posted up through Cloudflare, Neither address is permanent. Both addresses are ephemeral. They're kind of a reflection of the conversation, where I am, where the data center is. The address is really a token du jour. And in fact, it's even more ephemeral than that. It's just a token of the conversation.
So I guess what, let me try and just break that down into something a little bit different, just to restate it. And realistically, when in a network where the servers are using content delivery networks like Cloudflare, you're not talking to my server, which has a static address. You're talking to the content delivery network. The content delivery network has a DNS lookup, which is fungible. It points to the nearest IP address, and those IP addresses change at any time, literally on a minute-by-minute basis quite often. It might respond, if I was in Sydney, it might respond with a data in its Melbourne data center, but equally it might send me to a data center in Malaysia or, you know, wherever the other, if that was the way it was, because Sydney was down. So in a sense, my client doesn't connect to the actual server, it connects to the content delivery network. And my client itself, of course, gets an IP address on, say, my smartphone when it's on the 3G. It only gets a public IP address or a registered IP address as and when it goes through the 3GPP gateway where the 3GN is done. So addresses are ephemeral all the way around. And we're not the address, even though we sell 2 billion devices a year, out of those 2 billion devices at any given instant in time, only some fraction are active. It's about a duty cycle.
Right. So what we're actually doing is piling the overload, this is the way NATs work, into the port bits of the header field. Mm-hmm. So TCP has basically 16 bits of source port, 16 bits of destination port. So does UDP. NATs, if you work hard, can extend the IPv4 address space up to somewhere around 50, 55, 56 bits. Now, this is getting to be interesting because when you say, well, 36 gives us heap more addresses, it doesn't. Because the low order 64 bits, through some inspired piece of committee-based IETF lunacy, decided that they'd make the low order 64 bits the replacement for ARP. So you take a simple lightweight address resolution protocol and turn it into a massive 64-bit space gobbler and call it progress. Mm. Like, that just threw packet networking back into the Stone Ages. That was a disastrous decision. So I've only got 64 bits. No, you haven't. Because, of course, then they invented N-site addresses and N-site prefixes. And if you go to your ISP, basically your N-site prefix is around a slash 56 or so. All of a sudden, V6 doesn't offer you infinite space. It offers you around 56 bits. Mm-hmm. But who needs permanent addresses anyway? And if all I want is address space, I can just get there with NATs. So what's the world doing about V6? If you look on Google, you might find that there's a little graph there that says 10% of clients can now use V6. And that's all very well and wonderful. But the problem is that Google is taking a biased count. They're kind of counting the folk who can do V6 and saying, look, isn't it wonderful you can do V6? If you actually have a long, hard look at China and Africa and India, where populations are that don't have the same technology base and they aren't intense users of Google, then all of a sudden you get a kind of different picture. And the overall V6 penetration rate in today's network, around 4.5%, growing slowly. Mm. So if we really, really need V6 like we need water, then we would have died of thirst 4 years ago. You know, we're out of addresses.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of folk busy proving to the world in general, you don't need addresses the way we used to need them. There's another bunch of folk going, we need V6. And the answer kind of is, well, why? To restore transparent end-to-end networking. Fascinating. Why do you run security firewalls? Why do you run filters? Why do you run NATs? To make my network secure. Would you run without them? Of course not. You're joking. Well, hang on. Why do you want end-to-end networking when you really don't want it? What we're building is something entirely different to what we say we're doing. And that the underlying story with V6 and the huge sales effort that went behind it is kind of like trying to rebuild the internet of the early 80s. It was a wonderful network, but everyone had to trust each other. Is that the network that we want? And what is the network we're actually building? Quite frankly, the one glue that holds the entire thing together today is not addressing. It's possibly not even routing. Oddly enough, and you can get deeply depressed and, you know, maybe you should,
yeah.
The answer is it's the DNS. And, you know, there's nothing worse that one can say about the internet.
Yep, but Jeff, there's still an address space problem here that we're dealing with. Carriers and carrier-grade NAT has been dealing with this, so we end up with twice-NATed scenarios where residential users and some of the interesting applications they might be using for stuff as common as gaming breaks in those scenarios. And is that not an addressing problem?
So I write an application that breaks on a NAT. What's my likely sales rate? Well, zero. I write an application that works through NATs. What my sales rate? Well, as big as the world. You know, you've got to write to the market, and the market is NATs. You know, 9/10 of the internet is now behind a NAT, say the raw numbers. So if I'm doing the Internet of Things, if I'm doing anything, if my little thing can't negotiate its way through NATs, I'm wasting my time. I'm just annoying people and just getting on the wrong side. And how many NATs are in the path? Gee, I saw a bench test with 36 of them ganged up and stuff just worked. Now, I wouldn't say that's a good idea. It's a really, really bad idea, right? Let's just get that right out front. But, you know, we haven't even begun to really push NATs hard, because what you've got to look at in NATs is actually the internal architecture and the width of the binding table. Big NATs use what we call basically a full binding table of the source address, 32 bits, the destination address, another 32 bits, the source port, 16 bits, and the destination port, another 16 bits, and if you really want to muck around a little bit, the transport header flag. But let's just use those four port IDs. The binding table is 96 bits wide. So when you say, oh, they have a limit, the full theoretic limit of a NATed internet is 96 bits wide. And V6 is offering you 56 bits. Tell me again where the
math is
wrong. Are you
tilting at windmills, though, Jeff? I mean, V6 is, well, I guess it all depends on which pulpit you're listening to the preaching coming from. But, I mean, V6 is coming and we're all going and Internet of Things, oh, my gosh, we got to have that because of all this new stuff that's going to be added to the internet. I mean, are you saying just because the reality of architectures are public internet is hiding a whole lot of private stuff behind that, that V6 is never actually going to be needed? Or what is the role you see for V6?
Well, the issue is, and this is kind of funny, we thought we needed it. We thought the folk who said you know, no, we're never going to need it, were actually idiotic. We thought that this was just as obvious as the nose on our face. Devices need addresses. Addresses need to be public. NATs are just failures, you know, roadkill in motion. This is all just bizarre. But it's really hard to argue with 9 billion devices working just fine.
So I guess there was a phase there where network address translation was bad because it was one-to-one. So we mapped one IP address to one IP address. And then we got port address translation where we could map many IP addresses to a single IP address, so a single source IP address using PAT, right? Yep. And then we went through the pain point of where PAT, or what we call NAT today, was unstable, unreliable. We couldn't, our devices couldn't handle flow setups or state setups inside of the NAT table at vast speeds, or there wasn't enough memory inside of the physical devices to maintain very large PAT tables. So when you say, yes, you've got 96 bytes of discriminator inside of a header, if you look at that the right way, source, destination IP, source TCP ports, destination TCP port, you know, or UDP, what you're also saying is that your device has to be able to hold a state entry for every one of those 96 bytes.
My NAT has to. My NAT has to. And quite frankly, when you look at what's out there inside the mobile networks, because mobile have been the great purveyor of this stuff, they're big boxes. They're big blades. They're not mucking about. Does your phone work any worse than your laptop? Of course not.
Okay.
So is the internet experience any different? Not really. Hard to tell.
Actually, you know, in theory, there's a certain amount of latency added through every carrier, through every gateway. And latency is currently one of the most pernicious forms of value destruction that we've got.
You're talking to someone who lives 140 milliseconds down a very long submarine cable, and you're saying latency is a killer?
Yeah.
Some of us just have to live with it.
Yeah, some of us do. Some of us have better shots at the other. But even if I could shave, you know, 5 milliseconds off your trip by avoiding, say, a dozen NAT gateways, that's actually a substantial performance benefit. Right.
If I could take the TCP stack in your machine and fiddle with its control parameters for 5 minutes, I could compensate for 20 milliseconds of delay.
Right.
Fix the problems that you can fix.
Right.
You know, continental drift will fix the latency problem eventually, but, you know, not easily. So at some point, latency really isn't your problem. You know, part of the issue that we face in just raw performance is the quality of the software that's out there that drives the protocols. And the other part of this is, I think, some of the mythology that drives networking itself. And between the two, mm-hmm. we're kind of in the hole. So you're saying, well, V6 has obviously got to come. It's obviously right. Mm-hmm. And this whole idea that addresses are a fundamental part of the internet architecture. And I'm kind of going, wow, we're discovering something really different just right now in the real network. Mm-hmm. We're discovering that names are what hold the network together and that addresses are really a way of getting there. Mm-hmm. They're not important. They're just a waypoint. And that the large amount of the network we're using now, because of scarcity, rather than jumping into another protocol and all the cost of that entails, we started putting more and more intelligence into bits of the network to compensate. Now, this, oddly enough, is really natural. If I'm a network operator, how do I make money? By you having smarter devices? No. By me having smarter networks? Absolutely. So my temptation is to pump value into networking. Sometimes, like NATs, you take it into really productive places and it's a really good thing to do. Sometimes, like MPLS or SDN, you've just been listening to the devil. It's a really stupid thing to do and you should stop it or you'll go blind. You know, but the temptation of just throwing stuff into the network for a network operator is overwhelming. And I'm just pointing out that you can compensate for lack of addresses by having NATs and other bits of binding intelligence in your network that basically share the address tokens in ways that really we'd never expected in the past.
Okay, so you're talking about I think what you're driving into is that if only the network was intelligent and was full of, in its ability to track state and hold state, was a realistic thing, and I'll argue with that in a minute, then all of a sudden we can start to say the addressing actually is important, it's the naming. And I think you're leading into a discussion around name data networking.
That certainly heads, it's one of the directions it heads, this whole issue of it's not really the address I'm after. I'm really after the symbolic name of the resource. Mm-hmm. I want to route to google.com. I'm like, tell me an address, I laugh at you. Yeah. It's the resource I'm trying to get to. Yeah. And it kind of elevates what networking is about into what networking should be about, which is actually negotiating transactions in a symbolic space. And if you're looking at networking and where do we go from the internet, where we go from the internet of today is probably not, wow, 128 bits is the answer, we'll be there, it's nirvana, it's everything. Mm. It's way, way beyond that. And oddly enough, the sort of hiatus in V4 has caused the operations of the network to actually explore these spaces without even knowing they're doing it. Sort of unconsciously, we seem to be heading into the discovery of different modes and models of networking in different symbolic spaces, and that realistically trying to understand why we didn't all go to V6 4 years ago, why the network is not all V6 now, why folk are still out there going, well, I'm not doing V6 today because it's an expense, not a benefit. All of those kinds of views sort of sit there and go, there's something here beyond the incantation of let's all run V6 and we'll all be happy. There's something else going on, which I think is really a quite an interesting question.
So let me give you an opposing view there. The thing that is sitting there is that we have the middle boxes. So IPv4 enables middle boxes. And in fact, just to hold on to IPv4, there has to be middle boxes inside of the flow. So my client hits a NAT box, that's a middle box. It might be a proxy server, a middle box. As we move forward into an era where there's more and more encryption, I suspect that these middle boxes are going to be less and less desirable because you actually want to know that the source you're connecting to is a trusted source. And hopefully we'll get some time to talk about DNSSEC and RPKI and network integrity later on. But, you know, really, do you think that in an era of security and end-to-end encryption that middle boxes like content delivery networks and the cost of content delivery networks, let's not underestimate the cost of implementing NAT gateways and the ability of carriers to run those reliably, which has been poor historically, and for content delivery networks, the cost of producing an Akamai or a Cloudflare, those businesses don't run for free and give you networking, and nor do the carriers run them, by the way.
I'll go back to the issue that if I've got a network, I put computers in it. if I'm running a content distribution network, oddly enough, massive DDoS attacks are my friend because I can withstand them and you can't. Mm-hmm. There is certainly a massive tension between end-to-end security and what we're doing in the middleware. Mm-hmm. But the sad and ultimately very, very depressing observation is that end users don't really value their privacy or their security insofar as they're not willing to pay the price or go through the recipes. They don't understand certification dimly. I'm not even sure they truly understand the difference between the green bar, the lock green icon, the fuzzy yellow icon, and so on. This is an insecure site. Do you want to go there, yes or no? Everyone clicks yes. I understand what you're saying, that it's really, really hard to build what we in computing science would actually take as a purist view of an exceptionally secure and trustable network. Mm. It's really, really hard to build that in a network that is absolutely rife with middleware. But again, a bit like the observation of what's out there today in the real net, what's out there today is a whole bunch of middleware because, quite frankly, adding compute power into the network just gets cheaper every year, and that's what we do.
So I would level the accusation that most carriers are fumbling incompetence. And if we started to maintain effectively what you're saying is that they're going to have to carry state in these middle boxes. And I don't believe they're actually capable of doing that. They just don't have – they're organizationally incapable of doing that.
I find it hard to argue with a trillion-dollar monster that it's incompetent.
I don't know. The I'm seeing from consumption and pricing, I'd have to say that they are.
Right, but the issue is, you know, it has its own momentum and the money certainly, you know, moves the way the money wants to go. And these folk are basically just pushing value into networking. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, like I said earlier, they come up with really, really dumb ideas. Mm-hmm. And SDN is a really, really dumb idea. But what SDN is actually trying to add switching functionality into a network that never needed it. It's sort of trying to make the network clever. It's trying to make end-to-end tunneling a feature of the network rather than a feature of end-to-end because the network operator has only one hammer to hit the world with, and that's its network. So obviously it tries to cram stuff in it, and it won't stop doing that. Mm. To think somehow that if we get the ends right, the network will all of a sudden just become just dumb switches and nothing else is a wonderful thought, you know, and we had that thought in the early 90s. We truly believed that we could build an incredibly simple internet, but, you know, the carriers won't let us. They just, it's in their DNA.
To keep trying to value add, to keep trying to
every breath they take, every marketing pamphlet, every vendor on the planet is hand in fist with them because that's where the money is. And so when some operator says, I want SDN, you know, the line of vendors outside their door going, ours is better than yours, ours does purple as well as green, you know, is endless.
Isn't there? And so, I think there's a thing, that's an old-fashioned business model in a way. There are, if you look in other markets that have become commoditized, once upon a time you went to a supermarket and you always went to the upmarket supermarket because there was only one type. There was the corner store with the salesperson behind the counter who would weigh out your flour and cut the knob of butter, and it was always that premium service. And 30 years later, we now have companies like Walmart and, you know, Poundland or dollar shops all over the world just selling you the cheapest, most rubbish stuff because that's good enough for the task at hand. And yet in the telco world, we haven't seen that happen. It's almost as if, and in the networking industry, my pet theory is here is that we still have this this idea that networking bandwidth is a luxury market. It's like going to buy a Louis Vuitton handbag. People are willing to pay over the odds prices for it because it's such a precious thing. And I don't understand why we haven't seen a market emerge where bandwidth is just cheap. You should be able to buy it at a dollar shop in big, big packets. And it might be poor quality bandwidth, but it's also cheap bandwidth.
In the middle of the boom, in about 1999, I think it was, in London, up came an outfit called Band X. And they were going to be the bandwidth broker of choice. They were going to commoditize trunk bandwidth around the world. You could go to a Band X site and, you know, 10 or 20 suppliers would be there and you could take your pick and play the market. And it wasn't the only solution at the time. There were lots of folk also trying to get there. Mm. It would be so nice that if it was down at that point. Mm. But, you know, when you start looking about the provision of infrastructure, you're looking at 25 to 30-year long investments. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the provision of long-haul transit, you know, the fiber infrastructure, the submarine infrastructure, is actually a battle of bankers. It's actually a battle of money rather than a battle of technology. And that what's going on is, yes, there's an awful lot of, if you will, there's a very, very big funnel there and a sort of a choke point, which is the money and the investment. You know, I'd love to pull up a cable between Australia and the West Coast. And the real answer is, anytime you want, Jeff, just come along with us with the relevant $800 million. And it's kind of, fine, be there tomorrow, you know, knock on the door.
And then book the boat, which is on a five-year wait list. And
book the factories, et cetera. So in some ways, what you're actually complaining about is, yes, this is expensive stuff and the laws of physics make it so. Mm. And that, you know, right down at the bottom is a constrained industry that is just only a few seconds ahead of demand most of the time, most of the time. Mm. Some markets, transatlantic, have a subtly different picture. And there, over in transatlantic, up comes Hibernia trying to make a business case about 6 milliseconds. And oddly enough, they're kind of winning. But, you know, for the rest of us, in other markets around the world that aren't doing the Northern Atlantic runs, supply is still very much less than demand, and that creates a different dynamic, which all adds to the cost. Yeah. You're quite right.
Yeah, so if, you know, particularly in countries like Australia and New Zealand, where the physical distance away from HubSpot, you know, the interconnection, the cost of the cable that goes in is substantial and often monopolised.
Right, and that's why the stuff gets expensive. That's why, you know, prices only go so far and then they just kind of hit a brick wall. Mm. And that's when the whole argument about content distribution networks gathers pace and steam.
This is the argument about the cost of bit transport versus bit production.
Right, and so Australia's sort of trying to encourage content to rehome themselves here. The New Zealanders go, well, you know, Sydney isn't Auckland, guys. I'm like, it's still 50, 60 milliseconds away. You're not solving a Southern Pacific problem when you dump stuff in Sydney. And the folk in Perth are wondering, you know, where's the internet ever going to come because they're a continent away. So, you know, yes, there is a big push to try and redistribute content. Yes, it's kind of working, but it's going to take more time yet. Mm. But when you think about that kind of world as distinct from the world we used to think of as the internet, then I think you start to think about the V4, V6 kind of questions in an entirely different light.
Yeah.
Because when the whole thing is around mediating content rather than pushing packets and TCP streams, the symbolic nature of networking becomes more important than just the raw packets. So this is why, as I said, the V6 story is just so fascinating that we thought we'd need V6 so badly that by today, 3 years after run out, we'd be doing a billion new V6 addresses per year. Everything had run V6. It was all end to end. The NATs would disappear. Life would be wonderful. The reality is the folk who are running V6 have the double problem of running two protocols. Your machines are becoming quite difficult to manage because of two protocols. We're actually inheriting cost, not benefit. And right down at the bottom line, nobody is able to run a V6-only host right now, and we don't know when that's going to happen. Because if 97% of the users can only get there in V4, service providers need to do V4, everyone needs to do V4. V6 is kind of added cost, but it's not necessary yet. And it's that kind of strange twist that's just sort of delaying everything. And I was kind of thinking, well, what if it never broke? What if it never got resolved? What if this was just a fact of life forever? How far could the current situation go? And surprisingly, the answer is, well, a decade, two, possibly three, maybe more. This is weird. This is not what we thought.
Now, that decade long is based on some sort of analysis?
Well, it's basically based on the fact that if you use NATs as far as they can possibly go, instead of running on a 32-bit space, you're running up as an effective bit space is around 56 bits to number everything.
Sure. Yep.
And at 56 bits, you've got an awfully big number to play with. And, you know, in some ways, even with the growth of devices at around a billion a year, maybe 10 billion a year, 56 bits is still a lot of bits. And that will get us at least a decade or two of additional growth. Now, how we express those 56 bits has been the funny bit. If we do it in NATs, part of those bits are in the network. Part of it's sort of space in binding tables in active middleware, whereas other parts of the bits are sitting on your machine. So the address space is rather than you have an address and I have a different address, we're smearing the address across various devices in the network. And again, bizarre bit of computer science, but ultimately it seems to work.
Let's move the conversation. Yeah. Well,
this conversation's working. So what can I say?
Yeah, no, I must say that I've spoken to many IPv6 people and they all say exactly what you've just said, but I've never heard anybody offer a counter argument like you have, which sort of points out the stark reality is that middle boxes are delaying the adoption of IPv6. I know that IPv6 isn't being adopted. You know, I've written here in the show notes, users get zero value from IPv6. They aren't implementing it. And what you're also pointing out is the carriers don't get much value from it either. They're not rushing to implement it. And because they're not rushing, neither are the vendors rushing to get IPv6 support in.
Right, and then all of a sudden, IPv6 becomes a luxury you don't need. Mm. And when the bottom line is important, you solve what you need before you do anything else.
At the price of middle boxes, state in the network, and then we have to
network
trust.
Folk want to go there. Vendors want to go there. Trying to strip the network out is a bit like anti-gravity.
Let's talk about DNSSEC.
Let's talk about DNSSEC. This is a fascinating story. I'm like, DNSSEC is, to my mind, one of the most brilliant pieces of work done for a very, very long time. And compared to the woeful story of security inside browsers, the story about DNSSEC is elegantly nice. You know, every time another Komodo, that whole DigiNotar nonsense comes up, that quite frankly, what makes my browser go green is a bit of good luck and the fact that no one's bothered hacking at it yet rather than any fundamental security attribute. My browser trusts 1,500 folk who will issue a certificate for money. And now with Let's Encrypt out there, certificates get issued for even less than money. So what value is a certificate? None. Mm. And so the whole security of what we think of as the internet is founded on this phenomenal lie that it's secure, and it's not. DNSSEC, on the other hand, is brilliant. They took the very, very hard path. And as you design this stuff, it is extremely hard. They took the model of a hierarchical security model with one root. And so there is a critical key out there. It's an awfully critical key. It's held by, you know, the good folk at IANA. There's a copy on the East Coast and a copy on the West Coast, so it must be international, mustn't it?
This is the key ceremony, which seems to make the press every now and then, where the 14 get together and they all walk into the room individually and the TV makes a big deal out of it.
But this is the root key. This is sort of, as long as that key is held private and is uncrackable, you can create a picture inside the DNS where when I tell you an answer, it's the truth. It is the truth. I can't renege it. I can't say it's not me. And no one can sort of insert junk in the middle. And interestingly, for things like the Great Firewall of China and other folk that, you know, revel in DNS blocking and DNS altering and DNS monkeying around, DNSSEC kind of goes, you can do that, but, you know, you're going to leave messy size 10 boot prints all over the result. Folk will see you're mucking around in the DNS. So the DNSSEC sort of approach is brilliant because I think they had the discipline to actually insist upon a single-rooted hierarchy, which then sort of stopped the morass of nonsense that appeared inside, you know, the web-based securities setup. They just avoided it. Right. And for that reason, good points. Secondly, they completely ignored X509 certificates. And it's kind of applause, deep respect, because it's just some ASN1 nonsense from the 90s. It was just a bunch of committee folk doing an ordinary job getting paid by the hour. It just is irrelevant. The DNSSEC story just concentrated on the fact it's the crypto, it's the keys, let's manage them. And let's just dispense with anything extraneous. So in terms of minimalism and design, I'll give it full points. It is phenomenally brilliant work. Only one minor problem, just one. It's big. And the issue is that one of the things that we've neatly swept under the carpet about packet-based networking, and we've swept it so far under the carpet no one even remembers anymore, is that variable size packets are an absolute nightmare. Because when a big packet is trying to sort of move into a network that has a smaller size maximal packet space, what to do then is an unknown disaster. The V4 model was relatively simple. When you took a 4,000 octet packet off a FIDI ring and you sort of did the necessary bitwise machinations to get it onto Ethernet, you thought, damn it, Ethernet's maximum packet is 1,500. The V4 router was given the permission to slice and dice it into various frags. Off it went. Life was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Remember we were talking about firewalls and filters? All of the information about the filtering rules is in the first frag, because it's all about the TCP port, the UDP port. You talking DNS, are you not talking DNS? The trailing frags are just bits. It's just digital noise. Will you let the frag through your firewall or not? What's going on? And a lot of firewalls simply went, oh, don't like frags, going to filter the lot. Disaster.
And then there was a period about 8 or 9 years ago where fragments through firewalls were... We just started dropping fragmented packets.
Right, so fragments got dropped. And then along comes V6 saying, we have the answer.
Mm.
We will not allow folk to fragment forward. In other words, when the packet's too big, you can't send on the frags.
Mm.
What are you meant to do? Well, you're meant to send back a control message back to the sender going, I'm sorry, that was too big, try a different size.
Right.
Two problems with that. Problem number one, no one likes ICMP messages. So that critical message that says, hey, sender, send smaller packets, is likely to get filtered.
Yep.
Oops. Second problem, and this is a little bit more subtle. At various points, you kind of think, what's that source address mean in a packet header? And ultimately, right now, the only people who really, really need to understand the source address is the destination, how to get a reply back. And we have asymmetric networks like crazy. And if you think about tunnels and SDN and MPLS and all other kinds of unidirectional nonsense, and all of a sudden the middle might not necessarily be able to send a packet backwards.
So let me draw a parallel here. What you're sort of suggesting is when you think of an MPLS tag, it doesn't contain a source IP address. It's only a destination address for the frame or packet that it's routing on.
That's right. So MPLS is a whole bunch of unidirectional tunnels.
Yeah.
And packets can only go forwards. And that's a very common sort of cut-through approach with networking because, quite frankly, the reverse path doesn't matter. The middle of the network never needs to speak backwards. But all of a sudden in V6, almost, I think, unconsciously, we added this strange piece of functionality that said when the packet's too big, the middle of the network has to send a diagnostic message back to the source.
Mm.
That's kind of weird for so many networks today, and it doesn't work properly. So for those kinds of issues, frags, firewalls, V6, big packets are a disaster. But with DNSSEC, when I'm trying to do particularly RSA-based encryption, big packets comes with the territory. That you can't squeeze everything into 512 octets. Ha! 1,500 is a bit of a stretch goal. And quite frankly, the default size that comes out in DNSSEC is be prepared for up to 4,000 just to be on the safe side.
Right.
Going to go, oh, what happens then? Well, the DNS is meant to be able to fall back to TCP. When all else fails, bring up TCP. How many firewalls let DNS over TCP through? And the answer is a few don't. Not all of them do the right thing.
Yeah.
How many resolvers actually know that they can use TCP as a fallback? Not all of them. And in measurements I did, around 6% of users will not fetch a DNS answer if the answer is only accessible on TCP. Sort of, oops, that was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And so with DNSSEC, you get this amazing sort of protocol and amazing technology, and it's brilliant. And you run foul of one of the most fundamental issues about packet networking that we simply haven't solved properly, which is the fact that variable size packets are a nightmare when you're dealing with the big end of town, the big size of the variable size packet, because our treatment of them in the real network is so astonishingly inconsistent, and the standards body's treatment of them is so astonishingly inconsistent that it's no wonder that just things don't work properly. And so it's kind of frustrating with DNSSEC that a huge amount of folk have done an amazingly good job. Google's public DNS that seems to answer around 15% of the world's DNS queries does DNSSEC. Kudos to them. Wonderful job. OpenDNS and their service, the new services from Microsoft, Network Solutions, et cetera, they all do DNSSEC. Hats off to them. Around about, 17-18% of the world does DNSSEC validation. Brilliant. Now, compare that to 3.5% who do V6. DNSSEC is a runaway success.
I do think there's some possibilities there that might drive it. I'm thinking of this IoT, where we're starting to see, well, I sort of class IoT as the machine-to-machine generation that's coming next, where air conditioners and lights start to talk to computers that control them. Instead of today, most of the internet is built out of people talking to a server. So there's a fleshy computer somewhere that's trying to talk to a machine somewhere. The next generation will be machines talking to machines to say, I'm burning this much power, the lights are on, the lights are off, and so on and so forth. And DNSSEC might be critical to that system.
Well, if you think about tomorrow's world, right,
yep.
There's only two open apertures. There's port 443 over TCP because no one can stuff around with that.
Yep.
And there's port 53. DNS, UDP port 53. Nothing else is open. Mm-hmm. Nothing else is guaranteed to work. And so if I'm thinking of the Internet of Things, I would certainly be thinking about doing all of my data transactions, and I mean the lot, sitting inside DNSSEC signed DNS packets, basically running through the entire system as a series of questions and answers that convey all of the stuff I need.
So you talk about using DNS as a transport?
Totally.
Mm.
Why not?
No, I agree, but I'm literally trying to expand the conversation to make that clear. So,
okay. So you're quite right that this is a case where there are so few open apertures left in the internet. We've shut everything down that you're kind of forced into thinking about it's either going to have to go through HTTPS, which has a relatively high setup mode.
Mm.
You need certificates at either end, et cetera, et cetera. And the security models are dubious. They certainly make a lot of folk feel uncomfortable, and I can understand why. The other way of doing this is to actually just hook yourself into the sort of the dangling hook of DNSSEC and just attach yourself to it.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty about DNSSEC is you can't lie, you can't repudiate. You can actually time the information relatively well because signature values have expiry times. And if you synchronize the clocks, you can do a reasonable job of actually pushing stuff through, basically using the DNS as your underlying end-to-end. So for that reason, DNSSEC has a world of possibility. Even when we talk about things like routing security, there's this fundamental suspicion that what's wrong with using DNSSEC? And, apart from the obvious issue of circularity, it's tempting. It is so tempting.
So you're alluding there to things like the integrity of the BGP routing table.
Right. These sort of fundamental questions about, well, who gave you the right to announce that prefix?
Mm.
It's kind of, well, who do I ask? Where's that information that can tell me who gave you and nobody else, just you and your AS, the right to announce that prefix?
Mm.
You could ask that question of the DNS using DNSSEC, and it's likely that you can get an answer, a damn good answer, that you can validate yourself inside normal DNS resolution times. And as we all know from our usual experience of the DNS, it's quick.
Well, BGPSEC is largely for that goal, is it not?
BGPSEC went down an entirely different path. And indeed, it started, oddly enough, with what I think in retrospect was perhaps a less than good place, but it is where it is, which is rather than looking at it's just the keys and cryptography, which is where DNSSEC went. Our PKI started right up front with X509 certificates and said, we're going to use the awesome power of X509 certificates, which means by default it must be trustable and wonderful. This is not the best of decisions. There are very few sort of protocols that help you with certificates. You're holding a certificate. How do I know what you have? How are certificates published? Who's meant to publish them? How are they revoked? What is this revocation stuff? If I keep a copy of all the certificates you have, how do I keep it up to date? All of these sort of questions sit there. And if I was MasterCard, I can solve them because I'm MasterCard and you do what I say. But if I'm the internet, I can't tell you what to do. You can't tell me what to do. So all of a sudden, these questions about how do we move information around? How do we synchronize? Gets down into a, well, who's in charge of this? And the answer is, well, nobody really.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the RPKI turns into areas that are mushy and soft. And so fundamentally with RPKI is this underlying issue that if I have a delegated address prefix, I can ask my local RIR, I need a CA certificate. And the RIR goes, absolutely, have a certificate. And I go, well, I will publish certificates on my server and the world will see them. Well, I can publish all I like, but and the world will see them? How long will it take the world to see that I've changed something? How long does it take for everyone else to understand that something's changed on my local machine? And the thing about routing, as distinct even from the DNS, the thing about routing is that you and I and everyone else see all of the space all of the time. So with routing, it's not a just-in-case problem. It's everything happens all at once all of the time. And so when I publish something, everybody has to know about it all of the time at once. And that's an entirely different computing problem to the old DNS problem. Because the DNS problem, you need to know about it when I look up, you know, look up that name. With routing, well, if I'm being routed around the world all the time, then around the world needs to know it's valid. My credentials need to be available all the time. Subtly different problem. And so RPKI sort of tried to break it up into certificates, an entirely new flooding protocol. Mm. Always be worried when someone says that. It's obviously a disaster. Mm-hmm. They tackled the easy problem first, which is origination. That's oddly enough a very, very easy question. But origination is nothing without path. Because what BGP does, and it's kind of the magic of BGP that was the difference between RIP and BGP, is that BGP does loop avoidance by carrying the path vector. It leaves a snail trail, and it carries the record of that trail so that when you announce a route to me, you effectively tell me how you learned it, and you include yourself in that path. So when I announce it to somebody else, I say, well, I learned it from Greg, who learned it from Jim, who learned it from Bill. You know, so the path comes along with it. Beauty of that, you know when there's a loop. If you tell me a path that has Jeff in it, I'm not going to accept it. The bad thing is that that path in routing security needs to be validated. And when you talk about that kind of chain validation, Bitcoin won't help you. This is a chain validation problem that is literally one from the deep, dark depths of hell. And to try and make a cheap, secure, robust routing system, RPKI is having a lot of trouble. And I say this as one of the folk who helped invent it. I say this as certainly one of the co-authors of many of the specs. But sometimes your first thought's not your best thought. Sometimes it's a case of when you look at what you built and you go, well, is this really going to work? I think that's a perfectly valid question.
As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. It's kind of hard to see what you don't own, and that becomes a big problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services on outsourced infrastructure. Figuring out what's gone wrong and who's responsible can take hours, and in some cases, weeks. And what about planning ahead to avoid those issues in the first place? So that brings us to our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. Your corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider network, all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. Together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. Again, the networks you own and the networks that you don't. So let's consider this. How does all of this data from ThousandEyes help you out? And there's really three things you should consider. One, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance. In other words, you can tell what's going on in the internet BGP routing tables and how DNS is resolving, etc., and pull all that information together. Two, you can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems, device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, hijacks, route leaks, DNS failures, service provider outages. In other words, whatever's really going on, you can get right to the source of the problem with ThousandEyes. Three, you can take that data that you've found, those insights that you've gathered from the ThousandEyes interface, and then you can share it with vendors, with your customers. The big idea here is you can resolve your problems faster because you can say, hey, look what I found. So do you like what you hear? Good. Even better, there is a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. Sign up for a free account at www.thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and you can choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, network intelligence you can see.
Let's move the discussion to, there's a certain number of people who listen to the podcast who are young engineers who aspire to become, you know, better at what they are and what they do. I'm wondering what Jeff Houston would like to tell young engineers in any area or any topic. What would you like to say to them that they should be doing if they were looking to enhance their careers?
I think the first thing is to understand that most of what we play with is not right. It was the best guess of the day. And that you should be willing and indeed prepared to just question stuff. You know, the things people tell you is often based on mythology rather than on absolute fact. Source-based routing, good or bad? We used to think it was awful. SDN sort of says, oh, source-based routing is wonderful. You say it right at the front. Mm. You know, you sort of predefine paths. What's going on? Why does this work? What's good about it? What's bad about it? Rather than the sort of credulous, oh, well, if a vendor says it, it must be good. You know, if Cisco, it's put in the router, it must be good. It's worthwhile questioning and it's worthwhile wondering. Because in some ways, most of what we're doing, we don't know what we're doing. We're just playing with the bits. And, you know, most of this kind of playground that we play in is so full of unsolved questions that it's a world of opportunity as long as you're prepared not to accept stuff. As long as you're prepared to actually say, well, how does it really work?
Progress depends on the unreasonable man.
Well, in some ways, and progress depends on actually fully understanding things. Mm-hmm. Rick Stevens did us all a wonderful benefit by writing two obsessional books about TCP IP Illustrated. You know, they're still the Bible on my shelf. People should read them. People should understand the design decisions behind what we call as TCP IP and actually understand how they work. Because if you know that, no problem's too hard. You can certainly have an opinion about almost anything as a result. If you kind of sit there and think, well, I'm not going to worry about that. The TCP IP stack's all been done years ago. I don't need to think about that. You're kind of cutting yourself off from most of the cornerstone of the information on which we built the internet. And so I would encourage folk not to take stuff at face value, to actually try and understand these technologies and actually go back and even look further about what's the difference between packet switching and time switching. There's a really nice book by Keshav that also was, I suppose, really influential on me about why did the internet work and why was it just such a runaway success at the time when our second attempt, V6, has been quite the opposite. What made one revolution easy and the next one a nightmare? What was the difference between packet switching and time switching? Being able to sort of phrase questions like that and think about them and try and truly understand where they come from and what's the driving motivation is certainly the spark that lights my life. And I would encourage anyone else to think about technology in the same way, that it's not, you know, a sealed bunch of plastic. It's not something you can't unwrap.
It's not, I think the key word I got from that was, it's not finished. We haven't solved the problems. It's not, in some senses, it's a calamity in action or a calamity in action.
It is, and your Mac can go faster. Play with the CTL variables. Alter the way TCP works. If it all goes wrong, you can always put it back again. But, you know, explore and play because Apple haven't got it always right. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of sort of approach that the network is just a giant laboratory. It's not a finished product. And that, to my mind, that attitude is what makes this job fun. You know, it's actually what drives, I think, a lot of us in terms of saying, well, is there another way of doing it? Is there a better way of doing it? It is really those sort of great questions that we should all be asking all of the time.
I want to move to QoS. I remember a few years ago, I saw a wonderful video of you presenting at RIPE 65 somewhere in Europe, and you basically tore QoS to pieces and said, the idea of QoS in the internet is, well, you tell us.
QoS in the internet is a bit like equipping the fish with bicycles, isn't it?
That's what's
it
the
came
best
out of...
That's awesome.
It came out of this idea that somehow we needed to tailor the network to suit different kinds of applications. And that was all about thinking about telephony, because originally the telephone network was designed for one thing and one thing only, me and my conversations. I have a mid-range frequency of 3 kilohertz. I have a dynamic range of, say, 20 dB. My intelligibility is good across this range of, you know. The entire telephone network was built around human conversations. Even the standard 5-minute length call was the fact that most conversations die after 5 minutes. So,
actually, I think 5 minutes was because that's about all you could afford.
Well, that was partly this feedback mechanism. Anything of value had to be said in 5 minutes, now that's hang right. up and go away.
That's right.
And so the network was kind of tailored to one trick. And the assumption that was sort of behind packet networking at the time was that it was tailored for just one thing. And the idea was that it was fundamentally bad at doing different things. And so some folks said, well, I want to do voice over the internet. And it's just shocking for that, because packets get dropped and jitter happens. And I wish to recreate fixed bandwidth circuits. Mm-hmm. I wish to recreate all the overheads of a time switch network in a packet switch network. So the thought came along about, I wish to recreate, if you will, a range of responses in the network for different kinds of applications. I wish to have a network that has low jitter because I'm doing voice. I wish to have a network that has almost zero packet drop because I'm doing some kind of intelligent streaming video. But all of this stuff has failed dramatically. QoS has been just a complete disaster. But it's not for want of trying. As I said before, if all you've got is a network and that's the only way you're going to make money, then your first and fundamental reaction is to jam it full of variable services,
Anything.
Well, yeah. First class on the train versus third class on the train, you know. It's still the same train. It'll get there at the same time. But, you know, this idea that you can create differential responses. But that's in denial of one thing, and that is 99.9% of the power of networking is sitting inside your machine and mine. It's in the stacks at the end. And so here we are talking in Skype on the internet. Packets are getting dropped, might even get reordered. All kinds of damage might happen in the network. But the Skype application running on your machine and my machine is good enough to understand all of that and more, and to actually recreate what is a perfectly acceptable, I hope, playback of my voice in real time, and you and I don't care. And in fact, the application's so good that if the network tried to help it, it'd be damage. If the network tried to alter its response, Skype would be sitting there going, look, I'm very confused. Can we just turn this rubbish off? Mm. Can we just get back to a very simple model that says you deliver packets, when you're overloaded, drop a few, and I'll react to that.
To try and summarize that, and please tell me if I'm wrong, you're saying that because TCP has its flow control mechanism, any attempt by the network, by QoS to it, actually interferes with the TCP flow control algorithm.
Well, it's more than TCP. UDP applications do it too. Streaming applications are now very sensitive. Netflix and YouTube do an amazing job. So it's not just TCP. It's the way it's run. But the issue is, I have enough space and room and compute on my system at the end, even in my smartphone that was the supercomputer of 30 years ago, that I can adjust, alter, and tune myself to the way the network's reacting right now. You know, it's like auto cruise on your car, but rather than saying I'm going to go at this speed, it's I'm going to go with the traffic. I'm going to go with the flow and auto adapt to what's out there. So all of a sudden, if the network is trying to say, hang on a second, let's apply a red light here, let's arbitrarily change lanes, let's switch this over there, let's alter the way the network reacts and responds, then all of a sudden my adaptive systems, which assumed a relatively even network that reacted predictably, goes out the door. And that the combination of the two is, you know, just a mess. So I've spent all this money. I've bought the latest, greatest, shiny stuff from my router vendor. I've equipped all my systems out there. I attach a Mac and it knows nothing. Mm. I attach a Windows box. It knows nothing. The applications aren't talking into the network. The network's not talking back. How do I even know that it's any better than nothing?
And I think it's true that the applications will never talk to the network. I can't imagine how the network would be able to make a guarantee. Like, the internet's never going to be able to give a guarantee to an application that requests data or state. I mean, we tried it and it failed.
Well, that's precisely it. We tried it and it failed, and the costs involved are so horrendous that no one wanted to pay. Yeah. And the issue is, again, and I suppose the road analogy is brilliant. At 3 a.m, it doesn't matter how many express lanes there are. It's 3 a.m. Mm. Go as fast or as slow as you want. It's your call.
There's no congestion.
And oddly enough, at 5:30 p.m, even the express lane is congested. You've fallen off the knee of despair and you're now in the pit of no hope. Everything is congested. Give up. You know, you're stuck in a traffic jam. There's no lane going faster than you. And so what QoS was trying to do was to play with the peak hour traffic at 3:44 through to 3:50 in the afternoon. And just for those magic 4 minutes, it could make a difference. Yeah, right. I'm like, you know, this is never going to work, and it never did. But folk are still optimistic. Networks still want to stuff their networks with wonderful stuff. You know, glossy brochures are glossy brochures. And quite frankly, router vendors will do anything for a customer with money. And the combination is QoS.
I'm laughing, chuckling along with you, Jeff, as you go down this road, as a guy who's built some very large QoS schemes for some big enterprises. And at the end of the day, if it's a 56K frame, you're trying to suck the ocean through a straw. No amount of QoS is going to fix that problem.
Well, that's exactly it. You know, once you get to real traffic pressure, everything dies because it's real traffic. And when you've got no traffic pressure, doesn't matter what you do, there's no buffering. It just isn't going to make any difference. So for that aspect, QoS and this whole issue of integrated services, differentiated services, was kind of an idea whose time has come and gone. I'm a great fan of Andrew Odzlinko, who at the time was simply saying, buy more bandwidth. Mm. And ultimately, the answer for most of these ills is, if you haven't got enough networking, it's cheaper to buy more bandwidth than trying to invest in QoS. Because in QoS, you're going to spend the money. You still haven't got enough bandwidth. It's all going to end in tears. At least if you buy additional bandwidth, you're going to use it for something. It's a
Ethan, I think there's an echo in here.
We've heard this before.
I think there's an echo in here.
Yeah.
I'm not the first to say it, if that's what you're saying.
Well, I think I copied it from you would be a better way. If not you. So let me ask you a little bit of a challenging question. I want to loop around. So when I look at QoS, and what we did with QoS, we tried to put intelligence in the network. When we played with RSVP and reserved QoS state, we found out that holding state in the network wouldn't scale. In fact, it was a miserable failure, a sad, miserable failure, and I wasted a substantial part of my life attempting to make it work, for which I'm extremely bitter, right?
I sold a book about it, and it sold all of 10,000 copies. You can buy one today for 1 cent, which is, I think, what it's worth.
That's all. There you go. But what you said to me in the opening part is that if we put NAT boxes all over the network and content delivery network boxes all over the network with intelligence and reservations and state and all that, you're telling me that that's going to work when we know that it didn't work in the last 20 years?
Well, the QoS stuff was kind of dead on the runway. It never took off. It never went anywhere. You know, all the efforts, including possibly your own, who knows, never really gained traction. There was a small amount of deployment in the enterprise space, but beyond that, it was kind of, yeah, more bandwidth just solved it no matter what the problem was. With the whole address jam problem, there's no rapid alternative like more bandwidth. There's no quick way out of this mess, right? Just deploy V6 is a phenomenally difficult statement. Mm. You know, the whole issue about dual stack operation, happy eyeballs, unhappy eyeballs, you know, cross-eyed eyeballs, is a nightmare for every single application developer. So V6 is the answer, encompasses a huge amount of pain and effort by an industry that is pain-averse. So I'm observing, I think, that the reality is the path of least resistance, which also encompasses some of the kind of the wet dreams of the network operators, is to stuff functionality into the network. The network operators go, Yahoo, isn't this wonderful? And the rest of us go, well, I don't need to run V6. I avoid that cost, breathe a quick sigh of relief and move on. Mm-hmm. And so to some ways, I am saying that one worked and one didn't, and that's true. But equally, they kind of worked and didn't work for different reasons. And what's going through my head here, and it's just a bit of a, I suppose, being a professional skeptic in some sense, is that I always get worried about religious fervor. I get worried about religious fervor over QoS. I get worried about religious fervor over V6. And in both cases, the temptation to lift the cover off and go, is it necessary? Is this an assured part of our future? Is it negotiable? What alternatives exist? Are always good questions to ask. And I suppose the observation about V6 is, it's not necessarily has to happen. It's an option in our future, but we're exploring, literally in real time, other options as well, and it's not clear what the outcome will be.
It's more likely to be a slow, gradual migration to IPv6 than it is a big bang, I think.
It could well be a migration across to name networking and just simply ignoring the whole problem.
Let's take on the name data networking thing. We did a podcast with David Ward, and he outlined the case for name data networking back in a previous show. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. You know, do you believe that concept behind name data networking, that what we actually want is, why don't you just try and summarize what name data networking is in a very short, and then try and tell me why it's likely to evolve in the right direction?
So when one thinks about routing addresses, you know, 1.2.3 is reachable this way, 2001:4 is reachable that way. Oddly enough, they actually aren't addresses. They're just a bunch of bits. And the observation is that rather than just routing addresses, you could actually route a bunch of bits that translates into words. You could actually route the bits that correspond to the ASCII word tree. Or if you wanted, you could actually route the bunch of bits that correspond to the ASCII text www.potteroo.net. But what does it mean if I route www.potteroo.net? Well, what I'm really saying is that resource is reachable here. Let me tell the world by announcing that name in the routing system. And sort of fascinatingly then, I don't need to look up the DNS for a name and then use the IP address I get and associate the IP address and send packets. I just simply route the name and I send packets to that routed name. This is a fascinating sort of view of the world, because all of a sudden the namespace isn't 32 bits long, 128 bits long or 4 bits long, kind of as long as you need the names to be. And in some ways too, it sort of stops us thinking that addresses are unique, because names are not unique. Names are multiply instantiated. And so to that respect, if we're looking way out, if we're looking, you know, what comes after where we are with the internet, then name data networking is one of those places that's probably worthwhile looking at. Unlike SDN and the rest of that nonsense, this is not just refining a few ways that bits flow inside a bit-oriented network. You know, it's actually trying to change the way the architecture of networking and the architecture of the symbolism behind network is negotiated.
So I could imagine that something like DNSSEC would be used to say, I'm looking for this object, and DNS would return, it's in this location. Ultimately, everything has to resolve to a location, but
There is a secret phrase out there in DNS working group meetings, which is never repeated outside, except I'll let you in.
You and 10,000 people will be in on the secret.
No matter what the question, the answer is the DNS.
I can agree with that.
There you go.
Many years ago, I used to say, he who owns the IP addressing space controls the network in the enterprise. And then later on, I realized it's he who owns the DNS.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And with DNSSEC, you can't argue with me. There's no second answer.
Yes.
You can't second guess me. It's just, I own the DNS. It's DNSSEC. What I say goes. It's everything. And, you know, the other thing is that as soon as we try and think of other spaces, even Tor, it looks so much like the DNS, it's not funny. The DNS was actually an even more brilliant kind of technology, as it turned out, than even IP itself, which I'm sure Paul Mockapetris would hold dear to his heart, that ultimately this is this astonishing database that's scaled by billions. The fundamental query technology hasn't changed one iota. The scaling factor is truly awesome. Any civil engineer who designed a bridge to cope with one human that then carries the entire load of the entire traffic space of the United States across its span would sit there and say, job well done. You know, the DNS is truly an awesome piece of technology, no matter which way you look at it. And it's true, you know, no matter what the networking question, the answer is obviously the DNS.
Does that mean that you're a broad supporter of Lisp? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but there's a certain part of the Lisp overlay networking technology which sort of uses the best part of DNS to say this is how we should create overlays dynamically, but also have the central point of control of the overlays, which is, you know, done in the network, not over the network.
So one thing we learned about V6 when we tried 6-4 in particular, but also tried various other bits of IP and IP, is that we truly, truly, truly don't understand fragmentation. We don't understand how to cope with the fact when the packet's too big, what do you do next? And the answers have been a mess. And so the major problem why 6-4 was an absolute disaster on wheels was, oddly enough, overlay networking. I'm not sure that Lisp has actually solved that problem.
Mm.
And that while other parts of Lisp are really nice bits of work, dynamic address translation, care of addresses, dynamic management of tunnels, you know, this is all great stuff, and hats off to them. It's a nice piece of work. But ultimately, our ability to whack on an extra header on a packet and take it off again a bit later and do so robustly is a joke. I'm like, it's a complete joke.
Yeah,
it's like thinking the green thing in your browser is secure. It doesn't work very well. And this is not a case where we can sort of accept not very well as acceptable. It's got to work all the time and work well.
And even worse, it's got to work from day one. I mean, we really sort of, I guess part of what you're saying here is that, you know, fragmentation at 1500 byte payloads is the standard. And there are going to be routers in the flow that are 15, 20 years old. There's plenty of carriers running 10 to 20 year old technology in the core of their backbones. And those things aren't set for jumbo frames yet.
Well, not even jumbo. I take a 1,500-byte frame, I whack on a 20-byte header, I've now got 1520. I come to a piece of the core network that says it's 1,500 or you die, I've got no choice. I'm dead. And it's that kind of stuff that just, you know, overlays are really good. It's the fundamental law of computer science. When all else fails, add another layer of indirection. But the networking sort of theology can't accommodate that view. And one more layer of encapsulation often kills you. And I think that's Lisp's major problem, that if Lisp is done in an environment where you can control your MTU, knock yourself out, do whatever you want, have a great day. But on the big band internet, you're joking. It's just not good enough.
I guess there's a piece of me that says, I'm going to ask you about SDN in a minute, that sort of says there's things that we do on the internet that just have to operate at such a vast scale that things that we can solve in smaller scale are effectively immutable at internet. So things like 1,500-byte payloads can never be assumed to be changed because the network's just too big. It's fixed now. Is that a fair statement? The reverse of this, of course, is that if you're running an enterprise IT network, you might have 3,000 nodes, 10,000 nodes. It is actually practical that you could replace all those nodes inside of some lifetime, 5 years, 10 years sort of thing.
Let me come at this a different way, and we'll get to the same answer, but it's kind of the scary view of the world. The fiber optic guys are getting very, very close to terabit. So they can basically jam a billion bits per second down a piece of fiber optic. You know, they've discovered polarization and they've discovered phase amplitude modulation, things that the analog modem folk discovered 40 years ago. The fiber guys slowly thought, oh, we can use that too. We can make the photons jump through the same hoop. So these systems are getting phenomenally fast. Now, when you look at silicon, silicon density still continues to do Moore's law. Doubles every 18 months or so, more chip, more gates per square millimeter, you know, off we go. This is wonderful. But what hasn't happened is memory speed. Clock speed has remained very, very resistant. Production chips, state of the art is 5 gigahertz, has been for about 5 years. And the rate of growth is really, really, really slow. The fastest you can buy memory is around 7 nanoseconds. You can possibly squeeze it to 2 if you really want to go into cost. At 1 terabit per second, you've got 0.67 of a nanosecond, faster than memory. Now, if you just want to get rid of a packet, it's all I want to do. Mm-hmm. Look at the header, look at the fib block, get rid of the bloody thing. Yeah. In 0.67 of a nanosecond, you've got a fighting chance with enough parallelism. Just.
Yeah.
If you want to fragment, you're going to take a geological eon to rip the packet out of the fast path, send it off to a processor, blah, 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 blah. Even if you want to discard it and send back an ICMP message, compared to your 6/7 of a nanosecond, you're still taking an ice age. Big routers can't stand doing anything other than just throwing packets through. So if you want to muck around with the core of the network, the one thing I don't think you can muck around with anymore is that you cannot exceed 1,500 octets no matter which way you want to think. It's not just a virtual limit, it's a hard ceiling. Because if you want speed, you can't muck around with any kind of packet futzing right down there at the level of the transmission of the network. You haven't got the time, the space, or the physics, because clock speeds aren't going to change. Nothing's going to make anything better. Parallelism is linear, not exponential. So parallelism will dig you out of a hole slowly. And, you know, the fiber guys are moving faster than you at this point.
So well, you've also got state information as well. So for every munge that you want to do, even fragmentation, you've still got to hold state somewhere in the system.
Right. So you can only munge right out at the edge.
Yes.
Right out at the edge. And so this whole issue of where's edge and where's middle, if you're trying to do Lisp, which is kind of hybridizing and pushing some of that functionality towards the middle, towards the gigabit, 10 gigabit circuits, you're entering a world of pain over memory speed and silicon.
Yeah.
And this whole issue of, well, I could build that, but I can't make it go fast. I can make it go fast, but I can't build what you want. You know, it's those kinds of trade-offs that then sit there and stare at you right in the face. There was a really good presentation at NANOG last time in Montreal about what is the current state of art for absolute high-speed switchings. And, you know, it is a fascinating tutorial to look at, and it's a fascinating subject to also wander in, because the trade-offs they're making there don't accommodate any of the fantasies that I can muck around, even with SDN. I can muck around with packets as they fly past. You can't. What's in the header is what you've got to work with. And so from that respect, it's a nasty, brutal world out there, and you've got almost no time to muck around with it. Big central networks in big cores simply shovel packets. That's all they're able to do. That's all the time they've got.
Okay, I'll make sure I get the link to that state of silicon from NANOG in Canada from you and put it into the show notes. I think we've probably done that point to death. Let's hit some, you know, we're getting a bit long, but I'm still having a lot of fun and hopefully you are. I like to ask this question, and I'm going to ask it provocatively, is IP multicast a mistake? What's your thought?
Look, the only thing multicast ever did for anyone is it got Steve Deering his PhD. We sacrificed numerous good people to the altar of multicast.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of folk tried to do multicast this, multicast that. And if I hear one more S, G star join, you know, I'll go mad. Multicast is horrendously difficult.
Yes.
And it solves no problem worth solving. And it's almost like, you know, trying to resolve Fermat's last theorem. It's kind of, well, as an academic exercise, knock yourself out. But it's not good for anything.
Mm.
And so the altar of multicast, I can do broadcast TV, is kind of in denial of YouTube, which has got a damn fine model of the TV, Netflix, Stan, you name it, without even touching multicast. Multicast was one of those holes that the overcoated, you know, folk inside the telcos decided that as the ITU had put it on some kind of arcane tick list, they had to have one. So they went to the vendor and said, we have to have one of these multicast things.
And the vendors rubbed their hands together and went, oh, yeah.
Absolutely. It'll cost you a mozza. And by the way, don't ever turn it on because it's going to blow up in your face.
So that's pretty much the answer I was expecting, but I did want to let you say it.
Thank you.
You alluded a couple of times to SDN and MPLS as being less than awesome and that this and hinted at some sort of challenges there. What are your thoughts there?
I go right back into the fundamentals of packet switch networking. And at the time, and I'm talking mid-60s, late-60s, there were sort of these two models. And oddly enough, they were models around traditional telco worlds versus traditional data networking worlds. The telco world was always of the view that peripherals were dumb and could never be trusted. Mm-hmm. So that when a packet entered the network, the telco took it over and delivered it as specified without the sort of anyone else being able to take control. And so from their point of view, virtual circuits were natural Because if you look at it, that's what telephony was all about. You created this virtual state through the network. You corralled the dumb bits into the state. You shepherded them along. They could never cross the beams. It was always wonderfully secure. And you delivered them out the other end in the same order with the same timing. Hand me bucket loads of money. Thank you very much. I'll go home. So when data networking came along, those same narrow-minded bigots couldn't conceive of a network where the edges were intelligent and they were the dumb people. It was beyond their comprehension. So that when you talked about a packet that said, I know where I'm going, the address is in my header. And when you talk about a network state that simply goes, well, I don't know what I'm going to do with you until I get you. When I get you, I'll look up your destination in my forwarding tables. I'll make a decision, send it on, and that's the end of it. This was an anathema. So much of an anathema that they just couldn't stop doing it. X25 was kind of the protocol from hell. So they get rid of the lost bits and call it frame relay and make it new and sexy. Still basic nonsense. The whole VPI, VCI stuff in ATM was a joke. And then MPLS, which was meant to be originally from Toshiba, an ATM to ATM crossbar shortcut. The real problem was that Yakov Rector was sitting in the audience and Yakov said, I can do something with this. If only he'd gone out for a coffee. if only we would have been fed a decade of MPLS. And so later on, along comes Dave Clark saying, we need a non-internet new internet. We need a genie. We need a non-internet way of thinking. Then along comes Nick McEwen with OpenFlow and SDN going, I've got a non-internet way of forwarding packets. And they go, wonderful. It's just source-based routing crossbred with MPLS to form, I suppose, like any other hybrid mule, something that is impotent and unable to go anywhere. It's a dead-end technology with no scaling.
Yeah. It's only got a fixed 20-bit header, right? So anytime you want to scale past X number, like that many tags in your network, you're fresh out of luck.
Well, it's like many bits of QoS. It kind of starts with the assumption with SDN of assuming there is a God that knows all the state of the network at all the time, then dot, dot, dot. And, of course, the atheist in me kind of goes, mate, you just damned yourself right there. There's no way in the world you can amass all the intelligence to be predictive in advance. Mm. So where we are at the moment with IP, which was basically a self-repairing protocol that maintained a dynamic topology, there is no God, everyone has a relative view of the world, but that's good enough. And quite frankly, our dynamic routing protocols have scaled through the kazoo. To say somehow that there's a problem needs fixing, you kind of go, I know you want to fix something. I can see the motivation in your eyes. I can see the research dollars, and that's great you want to fix something. But claiming that routing is the problem is where things go wrong, because routing isn't failing. And to all of a sudden assert that there's a better way of doing things is kind of simply heading off into Lulu land then and there. Source-based routing kind of assumes this abstract intelligence that knows more about the network than the network knows about itself.
But surely these types of technologies can work at the edge, right? So instead of trying to control the core, I see SDN today anyway, I have many different, and it changes over time. SDN is an edge technology in that if you had smarter control over that, as you say, the customer technology, the edge technology, or the ingress point to the telco core, you could then simplify the, you know, remove MPLS from the internals because your overlay over the top is providing the services that you want. So if you're encapsulating in some sort of overlay technology, be it MPLS or, you know, VXLAN or LISP or, you know, whatever flavor of header you want, and presumably it's got to get much bigger, but you've brought out a very good point in the session today. I had imagined that we'd be at the point where we would have much bigger headers in our overlay networks, 200 bits, 240 bits as sort of where we need to be. But at the edge is where SDN says, I'm going to do something at the edge. Because today we treat each of the edge boxes as individuals. They're like unique individuals with no coherent strategy.
Let me ask you, I suppose, the cut-through question. Mm. What problem are you trying to solve? And I'll offer you two solutions. One is you're trying to solve a security problem. I want my packets to go a way that no other packets can flow. I wish to isolate my stuff from everyone else. So I wish to fence myself off, and SDN can do that, but so can end-to-end encryption. Or you're saying, I want to ring fence capacity. I want to ring fence a certain amount of me space that is not you space. And I go back to Andrew Odds, Linko and QoS going, mate, if that's your problem and you haven't got enough bandwidth, I know a really cheap way of solving your problem. Mm. And, you know, it starts with the words more bandwidth and just goes on from there.
So I think the question is a little bit more difficult. One of the things that I've got today is that networks are inherently any to any, and I need to start implementing arbitrary topologies for different applications. So, for example, if I've got the misfortune to be running an IP telephony system, I need an any-to-any network. All my branches need to talk to any other net branch because that's how the call flow routes from handset to handset. But I don't want the rest of my traffic to be in the same topology. I need it to be in a point-to-point topology and make it trombone through the data center where I can inspect and log every single piece of traffic. But I might want to have a third topology for internet because my corporate backbone has got 4 megapops where I've got my internet-facing gateways, which logs all the outbound traffic. So I don't actually want to loop it through the data center for internet traffic. I want to send that on a completely different topology. I can't do that in a carrier network. I mean, a carrier today can't even provision anything in less than a year. I'm exaggerating, but it sure feels like it. You know, 6 to 12 weeks is a minimum. Asking them to build multi-topology MPLS or, you know, build to do that type of architecture that solves today's problems just doesn't seem reasonable to me.
Right, but, you know, you're kind of doing one of these classic technology throws of trying to make your problem our problem and trying to say, well, my particular issue should be everyone's problem and everyone should solve it for me. There are many ways of solving what you want to do, and some of them involve literally rebuilding the application itself to say, I'm an application that talks through a trombone. I'm something that talks through a rendezvous point. Mm. You can't use applications that you just lift off the shelf and make them work. You have to have different ones. Or you can change the way the network routes packets. And that's a fine sort of class B solution and might well be cheaper. You use the same old apps, but you change the way the network responds. In the enterprise environment, I'll sit there and say, knock yourself out. You know, here's a switch, here's a terminal, here's some code, whatever you want. World's your oyster. But when you're sitting there in the big internet, which is where I'm sitting and sort of the lens I put on this conversation, of what does the big internet want to do? The answer is it's destination-based hop-by-hop forwarding. Mm-hmm. And anything else kind of gets into Lulu land really, really quickly. So while there are solutions for you in that enterprise space, don't try and scale them up and export them out because at some point it's a different world and it won't work.
And that's where SDN works, is it's able to say, right, my network is a destination hop-by-hop system, but I can lay something over the top that doesn't require that network to know anything about it. And that's where I get back to my stateless, dumb mega bandwidth core. And so when you say to me, and that's what I want because I want to provide the services myself. So when you start to say, in the internet, I expect to have value-added services in the core, I'm seeing this clash of cultures.
Right. So SDN, let's take it a little bit further. Did you ever run TransLAN switches?
No, before my time.
Mid-80s, wonderful box, had a bitwise mask that was programmable, and you could either forward, delay, or drop packets as they went through the TransLAN switch. Mm. Indistinguishable from open flow switches. And oddly enough, the programming language was indistinguishable from SDN. So in some ways, SDN is kind of a revamp of some old Ethernet technology of the mid-80s that was flogged by folk like Digital and others of their like.
I do and believe RFC respect, 1925 applies.
Nothing.
Rule 11, every old idea will be proposed again with a different name and a different presentation.
Absolutely.
Regardless.
Absolutely. And whoever still remembers TransLAN would sit there and nod wisely with me at this point because that's exactly what it did. Yeah. And there was certainly a need for it, and there was a big debate at the time whether to route or whether to switch, where to put functionality over at the edge. And this kind of thing is all about control versus scale. And over at the edge, control is important. As you're saying, I wish to use commodity products but have them controlled in such a way that they don't work the normal way. I wish them all to go through this trombone, et cetera, et cetera. Out on the middle of the internet, you lose control. That's never, ever, ever a factor. It's all about scale. And therefore, the engineering that happens in the middle of the internet, what is IP engineering, is necessarily, I think, minimalist and quite fundamental. and things like source-based routing. Mm. We played with it. We gave it up. Even hop-by-hop flow control, landmark routing. Gave up landmark routing and said, look, you put a destination in the header, you let the packet go, you give up, you let the network take over.
Mm-hmm. I agree. At scale, that's the only – so, and you know, we talked earlier about BGP. I think BGP is a great protocol for the internet, but it's not a great protocol in smaller networks because it's a miserable, slow, lacks feedback loops.
Well, a full-in squared mesh flooding protocol without any policy metrics and absolutely no link metric is never useful for anything other than inter-domain routing.
That's exactly right.
And it was always a failing of the vendors to think that they could morph BGP into something that it wasn't. Yeah. You know, it's not that. It's an inter-domain routing protocol.
Yes. And this is why I get a little – I've often expressed an opinion, which is a certain sarcasm for it's got BGP in it, therefore it must be awesomes. And because it's not. It's not BGP that makes things awesome. It's whether the protocol is the right thing for the job. Just because BGP works for the internet doesn't mean it works for your 50-node network. And in fact, probably the reverse is true. So I'm sort of seeing that there's a difference, there's a divergence in networking technology about what works for enterprises or for IoTs, which are going to be overlay-driven, or for people who want to build subnetworks out of network bandwidth, whether to do, you know, control flows or manage flows, get inspection, get security, get integrity. I'm wondering if there's a divergence in networking where what's done on the internet is one thing and what's done elsewhere is a different thing.
I think it cuts even deeper and further. Mm-hmm. I was amazed to learn that Facebook, the app on my whatever it is smart device, includes its own TCP/IP stack. They don't trust Apple or Google. They run their own stack. I was amazed to learn at one point that Netflix decided to stop folk doing the breaking the geo blockers, that Netflix decided to run its own DNS independently of the host, let alone the network. Mm. And so what we're seeing now is not just that there's an issue between the network administrator and the host. So I wish all my hosts to behave like X. So I will enforce X in the network and that will make the hosts all sort of whip into shape and do the right thing. You're now seeing applications sitting inside the host, and particularly internet applications, having an entirely different view of the world. And the paranoid app is already with us. Mm. That it's now quite possible to write an app that has its own DNSSEC stack. And it uses its own resolvers. It doesn't trust the host system, let alone the host network, let alone your ISP. It's doing it itself. And you can get into your own versions of encryption, such that the Netflix app will only speak to the Netflix servers, et cetera, et cetera. And so that now what you're seeing is because of this kind of wealth of compute and memory power and the ability to ship an app with a few, you know, hundreds of megs in it, the app itself has its own mini operating system, its complete operating environment, and it trusts no one. But equally importantly, it tells nobody else. So that Apple can't tell what this app is doing. It can't glean information from it as it runs because it's not talking in the way that the host system expected it to talk. Mm-hmm. And so that what we're using with all this kind of wealth of capability in the end systems, oddly enough, is not just more functionality, but heightened paranoia. Mm-hmm. And the application itself is trying to guard itself against anything the network operator might do, anything the host environment might try and do, and sort of set its own rules going, I'm working to my own tune and no one can muck around with me.
So you're suggesting apps are starting to have their own DNS resolver in them with predefined DNS servers so that Netflix can control where you exactly go to because that's...
Well, Netflix decided its geo stuff was with the DNS. So, yes, for Netflix in particular, the DNS is really important. Facebook does it too. And kind of why, you'd need to ask Paul Saab and Facebook about that. But, you know, Facebook are shipping the entire protocol stack inside the app. They're not using what's provided. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a third-party observer, I would have to say, well, you know, if you're truly worried about folk looking over your shoulder, this is a good way to stop that, to exert control right up at the app, to let no one else actually exert control. You hold the trump card. So certainly in computing right now, the app's gaining ascendancy.
I think a lot of companies are moving away from the app as well. So that's a cyclical trend. And there's now a counter cycle where people are saying, I can't write an app for an iPhone or for an Android and know that it's going to work in a certain way because everything underneath it changes all the time. And I believe we're going to start seeing more come back to browsers. I know a lot of companies have stopped making apps for phones because it's not worth the time and energy to do it.
Right. Maybe so does the that make sort of, so that, the so logically grown up that, so it's only the big people now play that game.
Yeah, so there's only
a serious game.
Yes, but you're making the point that what they're trying to do is they have the size and the wherewithal to guarantee security and integrity by putting it into the development phase in the app itself.
Indeed. Indeed. And, you know, and a lot of the internet is going precisely that way. And, you know, some of it is, I suppose, the concession that the whole DDoS attack vector problem is insoluble. Running your own website is a joke. You can't do anything yourself unless you're willing to sacrifice it to the gods of attack.
Yes. So a couple of questions in the end here. I haven't talked to you about network monitoring or network visibility. For the last 25 years, we've relied on the on SNMP. I would say that it's not been everything that we had of hope for, and it's probably everything that we deserved. Is there hope for visibility and analytics and advanced visibility tools in the future? Are we working on that with and getting real answers?
I'd like to think so, but I see a certain amount of cosmetic window dressing and the hint of something real. Changing ASN1 to XML or JSON is a joke, right? It's kind of, well, you're just changing the window wrapping. It's still a window. It's still the same problem. So it's not the fact that you've moved away from ASN1 as your data description language that's the real issue. It's moving beyond that, and you, I think, pointed it out in the right sort of terms. It's a data analytics problem. That previously SNMP had taken the view that the device out there was just a bunch of registers and that you could read the registers and set the registers and that's it. The device had no intelligence, wasn't expected to learn, couldn't really report exceptions.
Well, it didn't have CPU and the memory or the software to do it either. And then
exactly. So in some ways it was a fit to purpose.
Yeah.
So part of the effort is changing the data description language, sort of, yeah, well, great. But that's not really the big win. Part of it is trying to change the concept of how you're managing and what you're managing. Because the way we manage a road network, for example, is you look at the traffic flows, you understand averages, you know, your tinkering is in longer term and deeper than that. And I suspect that there is a lot of gold out there in the data analytics approach of network measurement and network management. There's a lot of gold. What I see is an awful lot of really basic stuff with Ansible and Puppet and so on, which quite frankly just strikes me as a little bit of SNMP++. You know, it's not a big jump away from where we were, and it's certainly not conceptually somewhere completely different.
But what about Yang and NetConf then? So
well, that's what I'm busy arguing about, that it's sort of the potential is so much better than the few steps of reality that are being taken right now. Mm. There's more that can be done. And it's just so difficult because what you're trying to do inside that space is to get the device to understand normality for whatever normality might pass for and understand that the exceptions are what you're worried about. And having the device sort of aware of that kind of state of a learned normality and a reportable exception and do so not just as an individual device, but as a network of cooperating devices that produces that state is the big, you know, intellectual leap. Has NetConf got there? God, no. Mm. Yang? Well, Yang's just JSON, really.
There are parts of NetConf and Yang where they're starting to talk about self-describing APIs where you can query, and that's an attempt towards to get through to intelligent configuration of the data sets that you want. So the data source isn't static and you can create it. And then Google's got OpenConfig, which it's trying to get some momentum behind, which is meant for a streaming telemetry-based solution. So I see some smoke, but I'm not sure if it's, you know, illegal drugs or whether it's actually, a fire that's burning.
So what I see is kind of the light on the far hill, you know, where I want to be.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if the smoke that you're seeing and the light that I'm seeing are kind of leading us both in the same direction.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I'm sort of going, oh, geez. You know, it's kind of hard to jump out of the SNMP bandwagon and think really far and clear. And I just sort of wonder in some ways if the window wrapping and the change of data format isn't being passed off as something more fundamental. And we need something more fundamental to change about network management. You know, there's just no doubt about that.
I admire your cynicism. It's a beautiful thing.
Years of training, years of experience in a telco. Did I mention I spent time in a telco? I think that's it.
Jeff, is there anything else you'd like to talk about on today's show?
No, I've just had a whole bunch of fun. Thank you very much for having me. It's been an absolute blast. Thank you.
Everybody, you can find Jeff Houston on his website at potaroo.net. That's POTAROO.net. And he also writes some great stuff on a website called circleid.com, which is where he contributes. And he also publishes a number of articles on APNIC.net. That's APNIC.net, which is the Asia Pacific Network Information Center, for whom Jeff is the chief scientist, which he self-describes as, "I get to sit around and do whatever I want, really." Close quotes. Fair?
Fair enough.
Jeff, thanks so much for coming on the show. And thanks to you and the audience for listening to this marathon Future of Networking episode of The Packet Pushers. You can find us on our website at packetpushers.net. You can go there, find some show notes. I'll get as many of the links as Jeff talked about and try and capture them and drop them into the post. You can email us at packetpushers@gmail.com if you've got something to say. And, of course, you can find us all over social media on Twitter, Facebook and LinkedIn. By all means, if you've got something to say, hit up those medias and get back to us and let us know. We'd love to know what you're thinking. There's also comment forms on the blog post. And if you've got the time and you can, if you could rate us on iTunes or on your favorite podcatcher, that's a great way for us to find more audience members and for us to be able to keep producing the show and run the business that we now have, that's able to bring you this sort of content from the sort of people that we're talking to today. But as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.